This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. This week, I am so happy that our co-host, Susan Simpson, is back. Hey, Susan.
Hey, it's good to be home.
You were down under, huh? Give me some Australian. Did you pick up an accent or anything?
No.
That sucks.
My husband gets his back when he goes back home, so.
it comes back with vengeance.
Yeah.
So we all got to see, I think, maybe the best selfie you've ever taken, which was in front of a cow being inseminated. I really don't know what was happening. Can you please explain to me what was happening in that picture?
So in Milla Milla, where my husband's from, it's called the Tablelands. It's big cow country. Like, all they have up there is like dairy farms. And they had a monument to, you know, local industry, which involves a man shoving a cow through a pasture gate with a dog barking. Only it does not look like a man is shoving a cow through a pasture gate. It looks like something very different.
Is that what was happening?
Yeah. He's just shoving the cow. That's full stop what's happening there.
Oh, my God. I was like, he is shoulder deep inside that cow. I was confused. Anyway, well, I'm glad you're back safely.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, is she going to survive the kangaroo wrestling and all that and the tarantulas? And so welcome back to the hell that is the United States. Things have only gotten worse.
You know, so when I got to Australia, we landed in Townsville. And as soon as we got off the plane, we're driving up. Probably like 10 minutes in, we pass a sign for a local politician in an upcoming race. And it has him smiling on the billboard, and it says, "Make Australia Great."
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not again, huh?
Not again. No. It's even worse. It's implying that Australia has, in fact, never been great. So make Australia great for the first time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read a little bit about the right-wing racists. There's some hairy folks involved in that scene, too. Yeah.
There are. And part of it's because Australia has a different system, and they have sort of more independent quote-unquote parties have more influence there. But in many ways, like, the whole, you know, Trumpian era started earlier in Australia, low-key, not everywhere, but it's definitely a similar sort of dynamic going on there as well. And there are Trump supporters in Australia. I met some.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Interesting. Of all the places. But it's not a two-party system, right? I mean, it's tons of parties and, yeah. Parliamentary?
It is. But again, they're really, you can see sort of the same dynamics that happened in America happening there, especially in the more rural areas. It's called the Liberal Party there, but it's not our Liberal. It's conservative, basically. You know, they have signs up and billboards in like major cities that says, like, "We love our Aussie values and flag." Just sort of, you know, low-key, blatant nationalist propaganda is kind of how that whole party rolls. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, it's kind of everywhere now, Europe, America.
Yeah. It's definitely not in America.
South America.
Moment. It's a worldwide.
Nope.
Oh, God, Brazil.
Brazil. Exactly. All right. So a lot's been going on, a lot related to Russia. So, Susan, I'm going to let you take us there.
Yeah. So I guess the biggest question for me right now is, when is this thing ending? The Mueller investigation, that is. There seem to have been a lot of reports I'm catching up on while I was gone about how theoretically the Mueller investigation is coming towards an end. For instance, Rosenstein is, you know, reportedly planning to step down, quote, after Mueller finishes his work, and that he'll remain on until early March, which, you know, would kind of imply the Mueller investigation is going to finish up soon. And there's like really vague unsourced reports from a few different outlets saying that everyone expects the Mueller investigation to end in February, which, based on how widespread it is, it seems like that's fairly well sourced reporting. But I'm very confused about where it's coming from or if it's as ironclad as the outlets are making it seem.
It kind of popped up for a minute and then maybe that's just a news cycle now, but it didn't have a lot of staying power, the story. On top of which, I wondered about who kind of put that out there and why, because for me, I mean, anytime anybody seems to announce that they will be resigning, they might be like, Trump just jumps on it. And it's like, nope, you're done now. I'm cutting you out right now.
He never waits. Rosenstein's been different from the beginning. There have been several news cycles now about how Rosenstein's leaving and then he's not. And of course, that's related to the whole obstruction investigation and the fear that, you know, firing Rosenstein would be more obstruction. So you know, it seems like that's really the case. But on the other hand, there is evidence cutting the other way that would seem to conflict with the idea that Mueller is winding down and closing up shop in February. Most notably, just today, we had the announcement that Gates' sentencing is getting extended because there are ongoing investigations his help was still needed for, which would suggest...
Meaning it's been postponed. It's been postponed. Like, he's not getting sentenced yet. Okay.
Which is a sign that there are other things that are still going on that presumably will not be ending within the next month or two. And of course, we have news again, which seems like to happen every like 3 weeks or something, that Mueller has passed on a Mueller interview or refused to agree to talk to Mueller in person.
Trump did, right?
Yeah, yeah. But that would seem to be setting the stage for a subpoena fight, assuming that Mueller is going to not roll over without a fight on Trump's refusals. And if that's the case, that'll take months to resolve.
Yeah, I mean, I could be wrong, but I feel like there's so much more to come with not just his investigation, but also kind of like a string of, you know, other charges and stuff. I can't imagine by March he'd be ready to roll and be done. It doesn't seem likely.
It does seem to me strange. I mean, I guess one argument is that Mueller has been very steadily farming out a lot of what he's uncovered to, you know, mostly SDNY and other,
right,
you know, prosecuting agencies under the quote unquote normal system. So maybe
you think Rosenstein's announcement has something to do with like Whitaker?
I mean, Whitaker won't be there much longer. So if anything, it has to do with Barr, Bill Barr, the guy who's being, who was Trump nominated to be AG and is currently being
confirmed as we speak.
Yeah. Turn it off to record. So
yeah. Yeah. And we'll cover that a little bit later in the episode.
So I guess maybe if like Mueller has like farmed out everything, which will go on for longer, then he could close up shop. But like you said, it doesn't feel like that's where we're headed. So I guess
some of the things Giuliani said, like lately, I mean, although Giuliani is batshit crazy, seem to keep hinting like he's expecting the report anytime soon.
Yeah, but like, didn't Giuliani say it was going to end in like Thanksgiving of 2017?
Yeah. So there.
So
I mean, I wonder if he's getting like, there's a reason that he thinks that, you know, it's going to be coming soon when he keeps talking about it. But yeah, I could just be making up shit.
Giuliani is so batshit these days. And I kind of wonder if he's literally batshit or literally having, it's just, he's so out there. Like, it's hard to see the strategy in it. And theoretically, he would be one of the more capable of the clown car of lawyers that Trump has. I mean this based on like opinions from 3 years ago, not like recent opinions. So right.
Him and Lindsey Graham, they got my head like scratching. I don't understand what's happening with these two people. Trump did apparently hire a whole new, like 17 new White House attorneys last week. And we'll probably get around to why he did that. But I have no idea who they are. But I'm assuming finally some competent folks.
Well, I would not assume that because I don't know how many competent people can actually attract to hire. But it seems like the recent White House legal counsel hirings have to do with, you know, the fact that there is now something in the way of check and balance from the Democrats in the House. So they're gearing up to fight against all the inevitable, you know, subpoenas and investigations going on there.
We're going to pay, taxpayers are going to pay for those attorneys, right? I mean, really sucks.
Yep.
Nobody else is getting paid, though.
Yeah, you know, of course, the underlying all this, the
shutdown goes on.
Continues. So what have there been like, have we taken like estimates or guesses on what we think the shutdown's going to go on for?
I mean, Trump is like, I'm not going to Davos because of the shutdown. And Davos is like, I think weeks. So I don't even know when it is. It's weeks away. I don't know what he's anticipating, but I don't think he is going to back down. The only way this is going to come to an end is if, you know, congressional leadership, GOP congressional leadership is like, enough is enough, you know, and they're going to be politically damaged enough. And they are. They're going to pay for this. I'm pretty sure. We talked about that last week with Waj.
You're very optimistic.
I mean, I'm not optimistic. I'm just saying I don't see Trump backing down on this. So if he doesn't back down, then how does this end?
There were comments he made, I think yesterday in New Orleans, that seemed to suggest that like maybe he was possibly backing away, saying like, oh, the border wall is just one promise we made. And of course, there's the whole setup now where you've got all these Republicans going, why are Democrats against border security? Implying that this is a fight over border security and not a fight over, quote, the wall.
That's just a branding thing.
Yeah. Well, the Republicans hope to win the branding war. They hope to have some kind of solution where Trump can claim he has his wall, so he'll be happy, and they can claim a win, but they can get the Democrats to be forced to accept it somehow. Even though we keep saying like the wall and then the barriers and stuff, I don't know if anyone's ever actually like sat down and like had like agreed on an official definition of what the wall would mean here. I know they want $5.7 billion in funding, but it's not clear like what exactly wall sort of structures would be built from that or where they built or like
wait, why would that- didn't you see that beautiful graphic that Trump tweeted? It's a little pointy pencil looking metal slats. I mean, there you go.
Yeah, but like where is that going to be built? Like what type or how much wall details, does Trump need to do details. Before it's called the wall? Like
I was going to say, he just wants the money so he can farm it out to contractors, probably, well, you know, like his buddies and stuff. And thinking out details is not what this is about. I mean, he doesn't have any idea where that wall would actually go or what it would be made of or who would actually then watch the wall.
I'm just surprised we haven't like raised a situation where we're like Democrats agree to funding that goes to, I mean, there are barriers at the border that no one is politically opposing right now. They've been there because they were deemed necessary and built for a reason. Like, why not just like, you know, fix it a bit and call it a wall and call it a day? Because obviously politically Democrats wouldn't like that. But I think that's the outcome Republicans are hoping for. Mm. I mean, we're fighting over a wall that no one knows what it actually would consist of.
Right.
So I just got back from a long trip overseas, and it turns out there is one electric toothbrush that's great for traveling, and that's Quip.
Oh, I totally know what you mean. When I'm traveling, it's the only toothbrush that goes with me.
Anything else that's electric is way too bulky to bring along, but Quip is great, fantastic, transportable, and also the best toothbrush all around.
It's also very pretty. Mine's pretty. It's like white and gold. It's very sleek looking. It comes in this like nice case you can carry. But what I love the most about Quip is this, and this is where I failed when it came to other electric toothbrushes. I don't have to go out to buy a new toothbrush head because Quip will send them right to your door. Brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for $5, which is kind of amazing.
It's impossible to find a more convenient toothbrush. That's why Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association. And they're backed by over 25,000 dental professionals, and they have thousands of verified 5-star reviews.
And what I also like about it is like the sonic vibrations. It's got these vibrations. It's got a 2-minute timer. Like you haven't brushed your teeth long enough. You think people actually think they brush their teeth for 2 minutes and they don't. 2 minutes is a lot longer than you realize, unless your toothbrush is timing you. And that's what Quip does. So we love Quip and you guys should try it out. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/45th right now, you can get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill pack free at getquip, getquip.com/45th.
Anyway, back to the Russia investigation. There was also recently a new indictment, not for Mueller. It was Southern District again in New York. And it was of Natalia, cannot get this right. I saw, apologize in advance. Natalia Vestelnitskaya, the Trump Tower the attorney.
Yep.
And she's been charged with obstruction of justice for her role as a private attorney for Prevazon, which is a corporation involved in or was involved in some massive ongoing legal issues involving money laundering. And the obstruction goes back to actually MLAT, a mutual legal assistance treaty request from Russia to the U.S. asking for information related to this whole investigation, which actually, it turns out, was written by Prevazon's own attorney, Ms. Trump Tower lawyer. In 2017, and there were more filings related to this case in which she wrote filings that falsely claimed not to have been involved in that, not to know where it came from, yada, yada, yada.
So that's what got her in trouble. That was the obstruction.
Yes. It was her involvement as a private attorney for this corporation and her use of Russian government resources through like an official government request to get information or to involve herself in a allegedly government investigation that would help her client and help her in her role as a private attorney.
Now, she's been indicted, but, you know, there hasn't been any kind of a plea deal or a conviction or anything like that. So you think this is maybe a way to pressure her into cooperating on other investigations?
I mean, maybe, but again, it's not Mueller doing this. It's SDNY. So
it
seems to me more likely this just was uncovered as a result of Mueller's investigation. And that's why he farmed it out.
Got it.
And then lastly, we have the mystery subpoena case. Have you been following this, Rabia?
This I didn't even, I just saw the notes and I don't even know what you're talking about. No, in other words.
This is the ongoing mystery battle involving a Mueller investigation. He issued a subpoena to a foreign-owned corporation known as Corporation A. The corporation refused to comply with it. And they basically had a contempt order against them where the court said, you have to produce the information requested or else. And when the corporation said, or else, the judge slapped a $50,000 a day fine on them.
Now, how does a, how does a U.S. court have any jurisdiction over a foreign company?
Well, that's one of the things right now that are like legally sparred over. But this is what we do know is that this is a case under the FSIA, the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. And what's remarkable to me is we still don't know. Months after this like case first kind of came to public knowledge, we don't know what the corporation is or even what the country is that owns a corporation. This is some pretty remarkable secret keeping, I guess, because at this point there are so many people involved who have knowledge of what's going on. But the court system and Mueller's team are, you know, have a proven track record of keeping all this stuff on lockdown. And in this case, the defendant has no incentive to publicize what's happening or who they are, which is why no one knows what's going on. Anyway, the FSIA involves when and under what circumstances a foreign sovereign, a foreign state, can be brought into U.S. courts. Now, in this case, it's a corporation, but it's fully owned by the foreign sovereign, whoever it is. So it's an arm of the state. And this, what we do know is that this corporation is involved worldwide. It does have significant activities in the U.S., hence the personal jurisdiction over it. There is power to bring it into court because they operate here. They can be found here. Some of the operations happen here. And the D.C. Court of Appeals, which had a recent January 8th ruling on this matter, found that the exception to the FSIA for corporate activity applies here. In other words, a company that does commercial activity cannot claim immunity in U.S. courts on the basis of being owned by a foreign sovereign. If it's commercial activity, commercial behavior.
Here, in the U.S.
In the U.S.
Right. Okay, yeah.
Which means the next route for the Corporation A was to appeal Supreme Court. They did that. Supreme Court did not get involved. They refused to intervene, which means right now, every day that goes by without them cooperating, they have a $50,000, you know, fine to pay up.
And that could probably evolve into a different kind of contempt charge, like, you know, freezing their assets here or something like that, right? I mean, like,
if theoretically?
If they continue to refuse to comply, right? I mean, like, if they are doing business here, they must have some assets here. They may have something here, earnings here. I don't know. I'm just wondering how they would enforce that.
Yeah, and I want to know who the hell the corporation is. Like,
who it is.
I mean, I guess it could be a Russian something, but that seems to not entirely fit the evidence we do have. It seems like some kind of financial institution is most likely what's involved.
What's your theory? From where?
I don't have one. It seems like it's a bank. Like my guess, if I had to put money down, it's some kind of bank or like financial services company or like foreign sovereign wealth fund has had some transactions with someone involved in Mueller's investigation. Mueller tried to get bank records from them and they said, hell no.
Got it.
So, and that brings us to the two most recent sort of groundbreaking stories. The first was the New York Times story, which was followed up on by CNN involving the counterintelligence investigation into President Trump.
Unreal. This story was incredible.
And yet, like in any other universe, in any other presidential administration, this would be like a breathtaking, nation-altering kind of big fucking deal. It's today in this world, this news cycle, kind of just another news day.
I mean, what's also breathtaking about it is people from the GOP actually attacking the investigation then. I mean, like, I think even today in the Barr confirmation hearings, I heard one of the senators, I couldn't tell who it was, asked the question, like, isn't, you know, I don't remember how he phrased it, but he said something basically like, isn't it unheard of for, you know, a counterintelligence investigation be opened on political grounds against a presidential. Wait, was he president at the time or was it during his campaign?
This was 2017. This was right after Comey's firing.
Right. So the way they're even like spinning it is that, oh, this again was a political move by the FBI, by counterintelligence aid, like to dethrone the president. And I'm so disgusted at the response of the GOP. Like they are just getting lower and lower. And there's nothing they won't defend for this guy.
Again, there's no daylight between Trump and the GOP these days. If Trump goes down, they go down. So
although they did draw the line at Stephen King, which I don't know what happened there, but
he broke the rule. He went at, well, we'll get in a bit, but Steve King finally crossed the line that Republicans pretend is the only line. So what we
he
know
just said it out loud.
Yeah, he said it out loud. That was the problem there. So what we know is that this happened in, I guess, what, May 2017. Trump fired Comey, and then we had a quote half dozen senior FBI officials who convened to figure out what on earth was happening with Trump and Russia. And in this discussion, which, you know, involved an opening investigation, counterintelligence. So the FBI does two kinds of investigations, criminal and counterintelligence. Criminal is like the, you know, stuff you see on TV. I guess you see both of them on TV now. But so criminal is obviously what it sounds like. Counterintelligence is not designed as a to put someone in prison. It's designed to investigate threats to American national security. So as part of this discussion, the FBI officials were talking about like what was happening. So they had the idea that like, okay, so here's what we know. Trump fires Comey. Trump says repeatedly it's about the Russia stuff. Could Trump have fired Comey at Russia's request here? Or is it something much different? Is it just that Trump has no improper motives, no improper connection to Russia, and he's just acting, you know, under his proper executive authority? And put that way, it doesn't seem like as constitutionally troubling as it could be. Because, so based on what the FBI knew at the time, there were a lot of possibilities for what could be happening. There's like the, you know, full-on, you know, Manchurian candidate thing. There's the full-on impulsive bad leader, but not at all Manchurian. And then there's like kind of a middle ground here where Trump could be totally innocent of a crime or of wrongdoing, but he is the unwitting agent of Russia, in which case this is a serious national security threat. So the Republican position right now, or the GOP's position, is that it was wrong for the FBI to look into this. They should never have done a counterintelligence investigation that involved Trump.
Right.
Even though, again, Trump could theoretically be the unwitting agent, which means the FBI...
But here's the thing, Susan. He could be unwitting, but I don't think at any point he has ever been unwilling. I think he has always been... He loves Putin so much, and I think he feels so validated with Putin's, like, giving him any kind of attention or importance. I think he would absolutely roll over and do anything Putin wanted him to. I think... He's unwitting only to the extent that he doesn't understand how Russia maybe might have been using him. But I think he's always been completely open to it.
Well, you know, and assuming that he was open to it in the sense that this was a genuine policy position he held. It was not like motivated by any kind of like, you know, bribery or blackmail. It was just genuine policy. Trump feels very strong about this policy outcome. That's why it makes sense for an FBI investigation to be done here. Because if Trump is a unwitting agent, then he needs to know that. And for the country's security, he's made aware of it. But in the current, you know, position we're here today at Bill Barr's confirmation hearing is that, like, the FBI even has all this evidence that is raising concerning questions. They have to ignore it. They're not allowed to investigate a national security threat because it opens the possibility that the investigation could theoretically uncover evidence that Trump was involved in some kind of wrongdoing or could have been somehow intentionally involved in a, you know, Russian plot against the U.S. So that possibility that the investigation could uncover wrongdoing by Trump is for the Republicans enough to say the FBI could never look into it at all, which is dangerous. If you assume that Trump is unwitting here, then that it's hard to see what basis for finding a constitutional concern with the FBI's investigation.
Right. It's not. It's political.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, the concern of Republicans is political.
It's not. I will say I don't think it's entirely political here. Because having a concern that the FBI might suddenly start a politically motivated investigation into U.S. politicians aimed at, like, undercutting democratic norms and institutions is, like, a real concern. It's not theoretical. It's happened before in our history, not that long ago, with J. Edgar Hoover. So this is a real possibility, a known possible outcome of the FBI's functioning. And I think being
if
very
the
vigilant,
GOP cared about democratic norms, Susan, we would not be here today. So I mean,
but,
yes, maybe,
but I have
but I will
too.
Not I, allow them that grace.
No, well, I share the concerns. Like, it is a very scary thing to think of what the FBI is doing right now.
Of course,
that doesn't
course.
Mean
a
it's not
principle.
They
obviously.
Shouldn't. Yeah. Not even just principle. Right. Like even if Mueller has the perfectly, you know, honest and sincere intentions, this could still result in a very troubling situation for democracy. I mean, like, look at how Comey investigated Hillary Clinton. I don't think Comey was motivated by any hatred for Clinton or any desire to affect democracy. I think he was just trying to protect the FBI's reputation primarily and doing what he saw as best for the investigation. But it still had extremely serious impacts on democracy and the future of the United States. So the fact that Mueller is not intending to interfere with democracy does not alleviate those concerns for me.
So how is this investigation, like, I mean, is it an ongoing investigation? Like, what do we know about it at this point? Like, where it is today, where it stands right now?
Well, it's it is now the Mueller investigation. And that's one of the arguments for why this was a bad thing.
I thought this was a different Mueller. I thought this is a distinct investigation separate from the Mueller investigation.
Well, this was pre-Mueller.
Like the Mueller.
This is pre-Mueller, before Mueller was. Right. This, the concern is that the FBI. So one conspiracy theory is that the FBI, after Comey's firing, knew that it was likely that DOJ was going to appoint special counsel, and therefore they wanted to expand the investigation as far as possible before that, so that when the special counsel inherited the investigation, they'd inherit a very broad, wide-ranging inquiry into Trump. So that's the conspiracy theory here. But yeah, so whatever happened that investigation, the counterintelligence investigation, that's Mueller's now. He's been doing that. So we've seen the results of it. And that's also why I am less concerned about what's happening with the whole FBI investigating the president thing, because special counsel is what is supposed to happen to handle this matter, to, you know, sort of minimize constitutional concerns. And if they knew that was likely to happen, which they had to have known, yeah, I don't, while I share the concerns in this particular fact pattern, I don't think it's as problematic as it easily could be.
Okay. I just ordered a couple of new Third Love bras, and I'm so excited because, first of all, as you know, Susan, it is not easy to get fitted for a bra, to get a perfect fit, like, all around, in every place. That's tough, right?
Well, that's why I don't get fitted anymore, because Third Love is here.
Yep, Third Love has a fit finder quiz. And the thing is, I actually had to take the quiz over because in the last 4 months, I've lost about 30 pounds. And, you know, you lose weight everywhere. And so I'm very happy that I have had to get a new fit finder quiz done and get a new fitting done through this thing. And over 10 million women have taken the quiz to date. It only takes a few minutes to do it, and it'll tell you exactly what your breast size is and your cup shape and size and everything. And the amazing thing about Third Love is that they've got 70 sizes. That's a 7-0. 70. That's amazing.
Rabia, that is a fantastic reason to need all new bras. A great excuse, too, to go shopping.
Yes. I gave away so many, and I bought some pretty ones, and anyhow, it was exciting to do it. And I love Third Love because, you know, the details make the difference, and they do have some beautiful bras. They don't just fit great. They have premium fabrics and gorgeous designs, so I'm looking forward to getting my new shipment.
They also have a new cotton collection. Third Love takes customer input seriously, and they recently launched their most requested item, cotton t-shirt bras and cotton underwear. It took them 2 years.
Ooh, I love that.
I know, the cotton bras are the best. It took 2 years to develop and perfect the cotton collection, which is made with a premium cotton called Pima. The result is a line of incredibly soft, smooth, and breathable bras that you'll want to wear every day.
Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everybody, so right now they're offering our listeners 15% off your first order. All you gotta do is go to thirdlove.com/45th right now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/45th for 15% off today.
And that brings us to the other big Russia story of the past week, which is from the Washington Post on Trump and Putin.
I'm pretty sure he ate the notes. That's just my theory, but go ahead.
Oh my God, I just heard, I somehow missed that part of this. And then I thought it was a joke. I really, I saw some reference to it and I assumed it was full on a joke. But lo and behold.
Nope.
And then remember the Omarosa thing? Like Omarosa's book, which I never read, but there were reports on it. She says she walked in the Oval Office once when Michael Cohen was talking to Trump, and she sees Trump eating paper as Cohen's leaving.
Yes. Yes. The man does eat. I mean, look, if he can eat hundreds of, we saw the spread at the White House the other night. If that's his diet, paper will do no harm to his system. But anyhow, let's talk about the context of what we're actually talking about. This is the meeting that he had with Putin. And when was this meeting?
This is five meetings over the course of his presidency.
But I thought this report is specifically about one specific meeting in which, I can't remember which meeting it was, but one specific meeting in which he did everything he could possible to keep the substance of the conversation secret. He told the translator that, you know, you can't tell anybody. He
took
the notes. He took the translator's notes.
So that was one meeting.
I thought that happened in one meeting.
Yes, but this is actually a pattern that's gone across all his meetings with Putin, which is part of the concern, is that consistently
Putin talks to him every day.
Putin doesn't have time for that.
Maybe he doesn't, but I have read reports that they do talk over the phone.
Yeah. Trump has time for that. I'm sure he'd take a call every day. But, you know, Putin's got better things to worry about, invading Belarus and Ukraine. So this story is, again, not surprising, but still insane. I mean, how can you make it more obvious what's going on? Like, we have all the allegations about Trump and Russia and all his concern and Trump's, like, physical inability to say bad words about Putin. And now he is keeping these meetings with Putin secret from even his own aides, his own, like, government. Like, right. There's no good answer for that. Like, in hindsight, like, 5 years from now, 2 years from now, we'll be looking back and going, well, of course that was happening because there's absolutely no good explanation for what was happening here. But right now, in the moment, Republicans have convinced themselves that there could be a normal explanation for something that's obviously incriminating.
I mean, it all kind of started going downhill when he had the Oval Office meeting with the ambassador and, like, didn't let American press in and just, I mean, like,
and it's kind of been the same pattern. From the U.S. Yeah. And that's part of what happened with Comey firing and why this counterintelligence investigation was open. It wasn't just Comey being fired. It's the next day, Trump inviting in, like, Lavrov and what's his face? I've already forgotten. Another Kislyak. Senior. Yeah. So, and Kislyak and, you know, revealing secrets from a very close ally that should not have been released.
Israel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And bragging that he got rid of Comey.
That too. So, again, the counterintelligence motivation here is pretty blatant. Here's the other thing too, though. Right now, the only people who aren't Trump who know what happened in those meetings are the Russians. So
the Russians, yeah.
Trump has opened himself up to being blackmailed, even if there's nothing there to be blackmailed about. Assuming that everything was on the up and up, there was nothing untoward that happened, Trump can now be blackmailed by the Russians because they can claim something happened in those meetings and he has no way to refute it.
But let me ask you this, Susan. If there is a counterintelligence investigation, an open one on the president relating directly to Russia, and he is meeting the Russian president, I really have enough faith in our IC community, in our intelligence community, that I feel like they'd be like five steps ahead and they have that place bugged already. I don't think
that would be disturbing. No, so that's, again, that's getting to dangerous land to have an actual investigation, have the CIA spying on our president during the course of the duties.
I'm not saying it wouldn't be disturbing. I just feel like when you have an ongoing investigation, isn't that what you would expect them to do?
No, not when it involves, well, if the president was not involved, sure, but the president is involved, so that raises some very serious, I mean, if I found out the CIA was actually bugging the president, even if Trump and even everything we know.
No, I mean, not bugging the president, but bugging Putin. I mean, like, you know, if their concern is this guy's an unwitting pawn of this, like, you know, this evil man, I mean, it might be that they're bugging the Russians and not, you know, because they think they're using this guy to destroy democracy.
Get around the whole wiretapping the president thing by saying, okay, we're really targeting Putin in his conversations with Trump. So from what we know, what actually is happening is that the intelligence community is using its, you know, spying abilities on Russia to find out what happened in the meeting. They are using their resources in Russia and other countries to learn from the Russian side what they talked about. And that's where their intel on this stuff is coming from. So
we're eventually going to find out what was his notes that he ate.
I mean, he ate them. Like, that's a pretty solid way of destroying it. You can't. So a lot of,
we think we ate them.
You remember the articles from way back when about all the teams people in the White House who are charged with, like, reassembling the torn up notes that Trump.
Yes.
So basically, Trump found a way to get around that.
Yeah.
I don't think that those guys are paid well enough to try and reassemble those notes now.
I know. I dare anybody to reassemble those. Once they've been thoroughly processed, it's not happening. Although, I don't know. Stephen Miller might do anything for this guy.
So, Rabia, how are you going with your New Year's resolutions?
Girl, I gave up on New Year's resolutions years ago because I never kept them. And you know what? 80% of us actually fail at sticking to our resolutions every single year.
That's why I stopped making them in the first place.
You never even tried. A very common resolution for people is to, you know, aim for better health, to just, you know, take care of themselves better in the new year. But there's just no quick fix when it comes to better health. It's all about starting daily good habits and then sticking to them. So enter Ritual, the obsessively researched vitamin for women. Ritual Essential for Women fills in all the gaps in a woman's diet with a fresh minty flavor, no fishy aftertaste. It's got vitamin D3, it's got omega-3. What I love about Ritual is, and I've been using Ritual vitamins at least 6 to 8 months. It's been a while now. You just got to take two a day and you're done. You don't have to worry about, like, thousands of bottles of pills.
So for those of you who did make resolutions or just want to get healthier in the new year, try Ritual.
Yeah. What makes Ritual easy, along with the fact that it's just two pills a day and you're done, is that it's a subscription service. It comes to your door. You're not going to have to go out and buy it. And, you know, I mean, like, I'll tell you the truth. When I have to go buy something from the store, it ends up taking me 2 weeks to get out to the store to get it. And I get a notification, I get an email saying your ritual is on the way. You can also snooze it. So for some reason, if you, let's say you're, I don't know what, for whatever reason, you don't need the bottle or you can put it off, you can just click snooze on your account, and it only costs $1 a day to have all the essential nutrients your body needs delivered to you every month. I mean, it can't get more affordable than that.
Better health doesn't happen overnight. Start your year with Essential for Women, a small step that helps create a healthy foundation for 2019 and beyond. Visit ritual.com/45th to start your ritual today. That's ritual.com/45th.
So we're delighted to have back on the 45th Ames Grauert, who was with us before, and Susan's lucky to snag him, especially for today, to talk about the confirmation hearings. Just to refresh your memory, Ames is senior counsel of the Brennan Center's Justice Program, and he's also the John L. Liu Justice Counsel. He's done a lot of work on criminal justice reform, but he's here today to talk about, and actually criminal justice issues, criminal justice reform issues are also a big concern for anybody who's like kind of examining Mr. Barr's past and his stance on these issues. So welcome back to the show, Ames, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's good to be back.
So, Ames, we've been recording for the past hour and have been missing out on the hearings. How are they going?
Oh, man. So, Susan, I was DMing with you earlier because when the hearing started this morning, Barr gave some really good answers to questions about his record on criminal justice reform. And to give you just some background, a lot of what Barr had said in the past about criminal justice issues looked really, really bad, looked almost like we were set up to get a Sessions clone. Barr put his name to an article in 1982 called "The Case for More Incarceration." Mm-hmm. When the U.S. prison population passed 1 million in 1984, USA Today asked him what he thought about it, and he said, "Good, it's going to have to get a lot bigger." So he seemed like he was very much, you know, brought up
pro incarceration.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And worse, there had been a couple signs that he. You know, a lot of people have changed their minds since the 90s. Like Bill Clinton had very similar views about prisons in 1982. Bill Clinton has very different views about prisons today. But Barr just a couple of years ago co-signed letters opposing the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, other attempts to reduce federal mandatory minimums. So there was a concern that, aside from being a throwback to another era, Barr hadn't ever really changed his mind on any of these issues. Which would be really bad. It would mean we're confirming an attorney general to oversee the First Step Act, which is one of the most significant overhauls to the federal justice system in a generation, who doesn't even really believe in the idea of sentencing reform or the idea of rehabilitating former offenders. I've been watching the hearings as much as I can today and got some good news, it seemed like there was some good news earlier when Barr, in response to questioning from Senator Grassley, had some really good answers. He said he was initially supportive of writing policy that would send more people to prison because he said he was getting pressure from communities most affected by crime, like communities of color. And that's probably true. Like there was a bipartisan consensus for more incarceration in the 90s. But Barr said, now we have to change those policies. And in doing that, we should listen to the same people we were listening to before. So that seemed to superficially indicate maybe he'd changed his mind. Maybe he'd come to realize that more incarceration is not the solution, like the rest of
the Democratic
Party.
The rest of the non-Sessions world.
Indeed, like the rest of the non-Sessions world had. But it's gone. I wouldn't say it's gone off a cliff since then, but it hasn't gotten much better.
I mean, Barr gives good answers. Like that is his only tribute that stands out from the hearing so far that I've seen. He is saying mostly all the right things, given all the right platitudes, given all the bland assurances that, you know, the kind of answers in a textbook you'd want him to say mostly. But how much of that is actually true?
He hasn't said he would recuse himself.
That one was troubling. But other than that, and the way he phrased it, I mean, plausibly, it sounded facially okay. Although underlying that is a deep concern that he's following the Whitaker model. But he gave good answers. So what's happened in the past hour, Ames?
So the thing that I was watching with the greatest interest is he got questions, understandably, from Senator, I think it was Booker, about how he would apply federal marijuana law.
Oh, no.
Sessions was famously, you know, one of the few people left in policy circles who still believed marijuana was a dangerous drug. Sessions had said it was as dangerous as heroin, which is just not true. So Booker asked him, how will you continue Sessions' tenure? Will you do what he was hoping to do, which was sort of end the sort of detente between the federal government and states that had legalized marijuana? And Barr referred to states that have legalized marijuana as, I think I'm paraphrasing, not quoting, but committing backdoor nullification of federal law. So if we were looking for an attorney general who would respect marijuana federalism, who, if, you know, California has said we want marijuana to be legal here, and then the attorney general says, well, we'll respect your wishes and we won't prosecute people who are complying with your laws, which was the Eric Holder policy, it doesn't seem like Barr is going to follow that model. It seems like Barr wants to enforce the laws on the books as they are. And that actually is now out of step with the rest of the country. Like, most of the country does not want marijuana laws vigorously enforced, especially in states that have legalized it.
Which is funny, because, like, the only point in the hearing where, like, Barr even verged on impassioned was when he was given this monologue about federalism and how important it was to make sure that we had, like, you know, send out authority to states to, like, apply laws and not have federal control of all citizens of the United States.
But there's always an exception.
That only applies to things that he... you know, things that aren't involving more incarceration.
Right. And actually, so Senator Tillis just tried to throw him a lifeline. I was watching right before jumping on this with you. Senator Tillis said, like, if I understand what you were saying earlier about marijuana, with a sort of like wink, wink, I know several of my Republican colleagues are worried about it. Is what you're saying just that if Congress really believes marijuana should be legal, then they should, you know, pass a law to do it rather than counting on the Justice Department to save our bacon? And Barr was like, yeah, that's kind of what I was saying. And
sure. That's a safe answer.
Right, right. So he's a smart dude. He's smart enough to know there was one correct answer to that leading question from a Republican senator who holds his fate in his hands. But it leaves me with little assurance that, you know, this was a chance to turn the page on the Sessions era, on the Sessions views that the only way is to confront, you know, drugs is with prisons. And Barr doesn't seem to be the guy to do that. So far, my take is that he's not a, like, unreconstructed drug warrior, but nor, like Sessions was, but nor is he the guy that's going to roll back Sessions' policies and take us back to, you know, a sort of fairer justice system we had before.
I can't tell if this is because he just has a flat effect in general, but he doesn't seem as, like, personally, ideologically committed to this whole anti-marijuana thing. Even though, like, more incarceration, he's obviously enthusiastic about it, but he doesn't seem to have the same glee about it that Sessions did.
But I think that makes him more dangerous. I think he's, like, you know, the guy who's, like, we can see it in some politicians. He's not a politician. And, you know, so he's able to kind of temper the ideological, like, craziness behind it. But the fact this guy, I mean, like, for me, the you know, of course, a concern about criminal justice issues, but, like, you know, his support of, like, expansive presidential powers. He says he hasn't read the emolument clause. I mean, what?
Yeah. A smart guy like this. That was
at some point in a 30-year career that involves being the attorney general. Yeah. He read it at some point. I mean, he might not be a scholar on it, but he would have a passing sense of it to be able to answer basic questions.
Oh, I forgot the other thing he said is under questioning from Booker. Booker said something along the lines of, do you agree that the criminal justice system treats people of color unfairly? And he gave a flowery answer that amounted to no, he does not agree with that statement. Mm-hmm. So he's not to really appreciate why we need criminal justice reform. I think the racial justice aspect is indispensable, and he's not on the same page with that.
Yeah, I can only hope that he is so committed to running interference for Trump on the Mueller investigation. He has no time for any of this criminal justice nonsense.
He seems dangerously competent to me, so I feel like he's going to...
Well, Sessions was really competent. Sessions was really, really good about getting his policies in power. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that there's evidence. I mean, he might be, but Barr might be as good at doing that, but I don't think that's a foregone conclusion anyway.
Yes. And the one thing I will say for Barr is he did commit to faithfully implementing the First Step Act. So, like, he's not going to be a worry I had with Sessions is Sessions so hated the idea of, you know, reform and was so diametrically opposed to the very idea of rehabilitating people who are incarcerated that he would have slow walked a lot of the, like, prison reform parts of the First Step Act. And we might not have gotten, like, good educational and vocational training in prisons, and which is achievable under the First Step Act. I don't think Barr is so opposed to it that he would care enough to do it, to do that. And in any event, he's now promised that he won't do that, that he will faithfully implement it, and people can hold him accountable for that. But yeah. it's just sort of frustrating. Like, we just emerged from a battle where we were fighting shoulder to shoulder with Chuck Grassley, not exactly, you know, a friend of progressives, to get a really good sentencing reform bill to the president's desk. Lindsey Graham, who's now the chairman of the House of Senate Judiciary, was right there with us as well. And I'm not seeing the intense Republican scrutiny of his criminal justice record that I would have hoped when I know they share our beliefs on a lot of these issues.
I am secretly convinced that the only reason Trump signed that act in the end and the only reason he agreed to pass First Step Act is not because of Grassley and not because of Graham and all the real work they did to sort of champion that through. I think in the end, Trump only signed it as a final fuck you to Sessions.
I wondered if back in September, I wondered if the way we'd get sentencing reform was like sentencing reform to own the libs, but to own Jeff Sessions. Kind of.
Jeff we'll Sessions, first and final good act.
Right.
So is this guy's confirmation kind of a foregone conclusion?
Yeah. You have doubts, really?
The fact that Grassley had to or felt the need to even ask him about First Step implementation shows it's on their minds.
But not enough to block it. I mean, Grassley is concerned about it, and he wanted to get his, like, in his mind, assurances that it wouldn't be interfered with. But I can't imagine. I mean, even I think he'll get significant Democratic vote, too.
I think that's probably likely now, and I think it will fall to the Democratic House and the, you know, Republican members of that body who also are on board with the bipartisan criminal justice reform movement to hold him accountable and oversight.
And of course, as far as I've seen, his record on abortion hasn't even come up yet.
Oh, I'm not even aware of that.
No, the question was raised, and he said that he doesn't foresee the DOJ changing their policy and their policy on Roe.
Interesting.
During his, like, 91, I think, whatever year it was, prior confirmation hearing, he made it clear he did not believe there was a constitutional – there was support for Roe v. Wade, essentially.
Oof.
Right.
And in normal political times, that would probably be, like, a centerpiece of all of this. And instead, it's like a footnote.
Right.
What about his position on – in terms of, like, sentencing disparities? Has he addressed that at all yet that you've heard?
No, I think he'd probably, he addressed it in the sense that Booker asked him about racial disparities, and he said he doesn't think he thinks the justice system treats everyone fairly regardless of race, which is, you know, not true.
I wish Booker had asked him, like, specifically, like, sentencing disparities, which are provable, demonstrable fact, what he would have said.
Yeah. I don't think he's been asked point blank about that, but I expect his answer would not be one.
You just step around it. He'd step around it. He was asked about a civil asset forfeiture, and he said he believes it's a valuable law enforcement tool. He said that, you know, he agrees with Session on the policy regarding consent decrees with police in different jurisdictions. I mean, this guy is kind of Sessions all over again in a lot of ways.
One note that is encouraging but shouldn't have to be is – one of the things we do at the Brennan Center is we track crime rates in big cities to try to puncture the myth that, you know, criminal justice reform means more crime. It actually is something or like the opposite. But when you tried to have that conversation with anyone in the Sessions orbit, it just didn't go anywhere. Like, they were not even on board with the provable reality that crime rates have fallen significantly since the 1990s. Sessions kept saying, like, we're in the midst of what's about to be the next crime wave. And then when, of course, that didn't happen, Sessions claimed credit for it, which was hilarious. but in Barr's written testimony that opened it up, he acknowledged, like, this is a very different time. Crime is significantly lower than it was in the 1990s. So he's at least dealing in reality.
Yeah, that's something, I guess. But, you know, grudging points awarded because they shouldn't be awarded, but probably in today's atmosphere, I mean, half points are appropriate.
Yes. Yes.
So, Susan, I have to dip out. If you guys want to continue the conversation,
drop off. We'll finish up.
Bye, Ames. Thanks for being on, and I'll be back next week, guys.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
So, I don't know if you saw earlier, one answer he gave that concerned me too, he was asked about reporters and whether the DOJ will be, I think the question was, will DOJ jail reporters for doing their jobs? And he did not say no.
Ooh, okay. I didn't see that either. And that's also the overarching theme I get from listening to him is that he's very much a rule of law, law and order guy. Like, he will enforce the law as it's written, and he will not depart from it for the sake of doing justice or doing injustice. And unfortunately, like, when you don't put thought behind laws you're administering, you often do wind up with unjust outcomes. So it strikes me that that's probably more of the same.
Yeah. His answer was like, he can conceive of situations where it'd be appropriate, like where the news has like run through a red flag, were his words, I think. And they know they put out stuff that will hurt the country, which was even more concerning to me because his way of framing it was if the news media did something that they, quote, knew would hurt the country, that would make grounds to prosecute them.
Isn't that just Pentagon Papers redux?
Kind of.
we've long since tested the notion that reporting things. Anyways.
Yeah. So it's. Earlier you were saying it wasn't as bad as it could be, but obviously there's a lot of concerns here. I mean, with this guy, it's just really hard to tell what is talk and what is not.
Yes, I completely agree. He also, a couple of things he mentioned in his opening statement, he talked a lot about wanting to protect voting rights and wanting to crack down on hate crimes.
I saw that.
Those are not what I would expect, knowing his record, to be, you know, the first priorities out of the gate.
So the cynical part of me wonders if that has to do with like religion, and if he's trying to, if he's branching off from this, being like, oh, there's like anti-Semitism is being attacked, and from there he does a springboard to like crimes against Christians, or like,
yes,
Christians being discriminated against is a big problem, so we need to address all of this. But that's me being really paranoid and skeptical of this guy right now. I've not seen like actual proof that's where he's headed.
I was very surprised by that, and I've not heard him expand much on those. I think it's low on most senators' minds, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I hate to say this, but like, it, in many respects, I think Sessions was more transparent.
Yeah, you knew exactly. He did not hide his beliefs on these issues. Like, you, for those of us, like Republicans and Democrats, who want to see a fairer criminal justice system, you knew where you stood with Sessions, and it was not in a good place.
You never worried what was just rhetoric and what was his true beliefs.
Yes. Whereas especially someone like this, you know, a lot of people have had very public changes of heart about criminal justice issues. It wasn't just Bill, who I mentioned earlier, like Hillary Clinton, Newt Gingrich, all of the, you know, power players of the 1990s. So it would, on the one hand, be very credible for someone to have, you know, for someone to, in their first public appearance as a future attorney general, say, you know, actually, I've started thinking about it again, too. But I would, until I see, you know, actual steps in action, I'd be very suspicious. You know, one thing that I haven't seen anyone ask him about is if he really is committed to this new rethinking of, you know, who we punish and why. One of the things he could do is he could repeal the Sessions charging memo that says you have to seek the most serious penalty in every federal criminal case, and bring back the Eric Holder Smart on Crime directive saying for some lower level drug crimes, if you meet certain qualifications, we won't charge you with a mandatory minimum.
That's a fantastic point, because that's fully in his power. That's squarely in his like, well, if he's confirmed, in his abilities, like in his jurisdiction to handle, and he could do it pretty easily.
Exactly. And I've not seen anyone ask him on that. We provided questions to the Senate Judiciary Committee and asked them to ask that question. I haven't heard it asked yet, but admittedly, I haven't been following. I've had other work things to do, so I haven't heard every question that's been asked. But
yeah, that's disappointing, because I mean, that would make a huge practical difference. I mean, just in terms of retention as well, there's plenty of DOJ attorneys out there who have left the department in part or in large part because of those sentencing rules now, which require them to seek extreme sentences in cases where they otherwise never would have.
Yes, exactly. And it would be a very easy way for him to show, like, I'm going to commit to doing something that that will make the Republicans and Democrats who support reform happy. And here's a tangible thing I can do to prove my good faith to you. I'm a little surprised that no one in the, you know, Grassley or Durbin offices recommended that the senators ask them that, or maybe it just didn't happen yet. But I hope that's next on the list for one of them.
Well, round two still has some time to go. So here's to hoping someone will actually ask a really obvious and important question.
Indeed.
And next week, we'll be back in the 45th to discuss the Mueller investigation side of the Barr confirmation hearings and Barr's refusal to recuse if instructed to by the Ethics Council. So that's all for this week. And thanks for listening to the 45th. And thanks so much to Ames Grauert for talking to us about Barr and what to expect in criminal justice under his administration.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.